You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
This is episode 11 of Stable Riding with Solange. This is Solange Ellis, founder of Stable Riding for July 28th, 2026. This is episode 11 of Stable Riding with Solange, part of Horses in the Morning. I am here the fourth Tuesday of every month to talk to you all about the rider and how we can make ourselves better in the saddle. Okay, listeners, I have a slight disclaimer. On today's show, I have a male guest named John, and in part of his interview, him and I both discuss male anatomy and female anatomy and the challenges that riders sometimes have with either their female parts or their male parts. So if this is something that you don't want to listen to, you can kind of skip through, I believe it's like question number 5 on his list. And then after that, we get back to our normal talk. So little disclaimer, we do discuss female and male anatomy later in this episode. Stable riding is for all riders. That's one of those slogans that is deceptively simple. See, we wanted something short and easy to digest that encapsulates a much broader and complex idea. That idea is that if we combine the laws of physics, the base motion and movements of a horse's body, as well as the base motions and movements of a human body, we can create a flowchart that allows the rider to know how to place their skeleton for maximum stability and ease on the horse's back. Following that, the horse will travel happier, freer, and with less wear and tear on their bodies as the rider is moving forward with them. Not just posing on top of them, not fighting against them, not clinging on and praying for dear life, but moving forward with them. Since horses move a certain way, and since humans move a certain way, once you understand it, it's not that hard to start arranging the variables differently, to consider that the horse may have a high head carriage or a low one, an upright motion or a forward one. And on the human's end, we can start to slot in individual rider body geometry, leg length, torso length, arm length, mass distribution, and chest circumference. Last month, we talked about short ladies, and I have my full-chested rider episode coming up in the next few months. So we're touching on those topics here on the pod. The next layer you can add is human body history and injury history. So far in past episodes, I've interviewed both my rider with cerebral palsy and a rider who made a successful comeback into riding after some big falls that resulted in major injuries. Every rider has a story and a history unique unto themselves. Humans are endlessly complex, which is why, to be totally honest, I transitioned from horse trainer into rider coaching. Dear listener, I was a good horse trainer. I had consistent and replicatable results in the horses I broke and those I trained. It came easily to me. Horses are easy. Humans are hard. Training riders is way more involved, complicated, and challenging than training horses. I've done both. You can trust me. It's true. Because of the lab, its tools, and the type of instruction I give, and the languaging I use, I get a lot of riders who have complex body histories and injury histories. I also like to think that my general vibe helps, or aura, as the kids are calling it these days. I make it a point to meet all riders exactly where they are without judgment, and I give them all the same quality of instruction. My Mongol Derby and Gaucho Derby riders are taken just as seriously here as a rider who's scared to mount or dismount after a confidence-losing event. I take just as seriously explaining to a new rider how to stand up in their stirrups as I will someone who's working on jumping big coops at speed in the hunt field. Because again, stable riding is for all riders. I'll often meet a rider who has already made some modifications to their riding based on their injury history that could be in some horse circles looked down on or be labeled or judged as being wrong. I've had riders who have to mount or dismount from the offside, riders who have to dismount onto a platform, and riders who mix and modify tack. putting English and Western pieces together, or riding with their stirrups set at different lengths. I have a rider now whom I support who has had multiple hip surgeries, and she prefers to ride with her Western trail like pommel bags on backwards, as she likes the tactile sensation of the bags touching her thighs. It helps her orient herself in the saddle. When I meet these riders, they often, very early in the interaction, list off the things they're doing quote-unquote wrong to support themselves in doing what they love. Sometimes in a tone of voice where you can tell they've had to explain or maybe even defend these purposeful choices many times before in the past. And I always tell them, none of that bothers me. If that works, keep doing it. And also maybe along the way of working together, we can try some other things and workshop how to make even more modifications to support you. And these modifications are rarely ever traditional. But the more riders I meet and the more I know how small that traditional box is, I see constantly that an overly strict adherence to that dogma is pushing riders out of our sport. But I digress. When we talk about riders with injuries, we often assume that they're horseback riding injuries because so many riders accumulate injuries from riding and falling. And maybe we should think about that statement a little longer. When we talk about riders with injuries, we often assume that they are horseback riding related injuries. Why do we have this immediate assumption? Well, probably because we all know so many injured riders or have sustained riding injuries ourselves. To the extent that these injuries often become an almost social rite of passage among us. Now you're a real rider. Look, I'm not saying that riding a horse does not carry obvious inherent risk. And of course, with the frequency, the odds of a fall, bump, or scrape go up. A realistic rule of thumb that I've told my riders and students for years is as follows. If you increase your horse exposure past once a week lesson to multiple day a week leasing or ownership or an everyday interaction if you're keeping your horses at home, you'll probably have a small physical incident about once every 12 to 18 months. Your toe gets stepped on. Maybe you get nipped or kicked. You and your horse accidentally bump heads in the cross ties, etc. You can then expect a bigger physical incident every 3 to 5 years. A fall, maybe a sprain. Your butt or your back hurts for a few days or even weeks. This is, I feel, an acceptable amount of physical cost. More falls or injuries than that? Now I recommend, as a professional, that some stability-based changes should be made in your riding moving forward. See, horse people are just really horse crazy. So much so that we often forget that there's a big, old, wide world of risk, sport, and injury that have nothing to do with horses. And some of my Fabergé egg riders, my riders who I really don't want to drop, come to me with an injury that they collected, not on a horse. I have many bad car accident riders, as well as injured my knee playing college sports riders. Sometimes a rider will hurt themselves in a non-horse activity during the course of their riding career, and some start with an injury. And I have one of those riders for today's episode. To continue my streak of best podcast guests ever, I have the amazing John. I met John the best possible way. The very first time I brought riders out with me to the Rocky Fork Headley Hounds, I brought, I think, 8 riders and 3 trailers. We were all competent fast riders and therefore had decided to ride in the first flight or the first feel of riders, which is the fastest group. I'm bustling about getting 7 other riders on horses, stock ties tied, tack checked, boots wiped, etc. When John makes his way over and introduces himself as first field master, he explains that they go pretty fast. And is that going to be okay with my whole group? And I remember saying to him, look, you don't know me and I don't know you. And this hunt is about to start, so we don't have a lot of time. But if I show up and I say my riders can go fast, they can go fast. And if I have not fast riders, well, then I'll just go in 2nd or 3rd. You don't have to worry about me. You don't have to worry about us. You just do you. I promise you can trust me. And dear listeners, we did go fast. And I remember loving every second. I also remember that it was November time and really cold out. So John had on those thick winter riding gloves, to which he had printed off and laminated a teeny tiny map of the territory and pinned it to the back of his glove. Then on the same wrist, he had a compass watch. something to this day that I think is one of the smartest things I've ever seen a field leader do. At the end of this really great hunt, as we're untacking and loading up the trailers, John approaches me again. And with the most earnest tone and open expression, he looked deep into my eyes and said some of the best words a man has ever said to me. "Was that okay? Was that fast enough, Solange? I can go faster next time." Ah, be still my heart. At that exact second in time, I knew that we were at the beginning of a beautiful friendship. John is my guest for this episode, not only because he goes as fast as I want to go, which is honestly pretty rare, but because John came into riding both as an adult and also with a very serious injury from a different sport in his life, which allows him to tell a unique story in keeping with my rider body theme that I have going on here at the moment. John, hello. Thank you for being on the pod.
Oh, it's great. Great honor, Solange. We're going to have fun today.
We're going to have a lot of fun. I remember meeting you the very first time at our Taft fixture when I brought seven other riders with me and we rode first and followed you that day. Do you remember that?
Yes, I do. Yes, I do.
And that's pretty good for us because that was pre-COVID. That was like, what, eight years ago now, probably?
Yeah. Maybe nine?
And we've hunted a lot. So I always say if I remember something about fox hunting, it was really in there, you know?
Well, you guys are always fun, Solange. I mean, the group you bring is so, they can ride and they have and there's a lot of smiles. So
yes, we always take great pictures because we're always laughing.
Yes.
All right, John, are you ready for the fun part? Are you ready for the questions?
Oh, yeah.
Can you tell us your age and how long you've been riding?
Okay, so 69, going to be 70 in September. Started riding mid-40s and took my daughter to a horse barn in Ohio for a school outing.
Yeah.
And I was like, I would really like to do this someday.
No way. Is that, you know, it's so funny that this is the first time I'm hearing this.
Yeah. Bonnybrook Farms in Centerville, Ohio.
Wow.
Yeah. And so I remember
you just knew right then it was something you want to do?
Yeah, it just struck me. And I've always kind of been interested in fox hunting and I was Polo Magazine's photographer.
Right.
So they would send me around the world and photograph polo matches. And of course, there was a bunch of fox hunters in with the polo people.
Yes, there's and a big so overlap.
So that kind of spiked my interest. So,
isn't that so cool how stuff starts, you know?
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So you're a really interesting case, John, as you started your riding career, both as an adult and with a significant non-riding injury. Can you tell us the story of your ankle injury as well as the modifications that you made to your riding because of it?
Okay. So back in 1985, before you were born.
The year I was born. The year I was born.
Before your parents were born.
Right.
And so I was skiing a really intense Mulga run and snow skiing. And the binding didn't release. So the ankle shattered. Actually, it was they see these accidents. They see that this type of injury, ankle injury, and suicides and motorcycle accidents.
Ugh.
It was just this huge compression. So the bones were all shattered. And they came back and they put me together. And I left and it started swelling. And what happened is it got staph infection in the bones.
Oh, no.
So we went back to the hospital and they tried to save the leg and almost had to amputate it. It was pretty touch and go. So they saved it, long rehab, and then it was just a nasty ankle for a long time. So
now that's a lot of math for me to do while I'm also being professional and recording. How old were you when you hurt your ankle skiing?
So, gosh, that was 50 years. Yeah, so probably in my 30s.
So you were young and they're like, you might have to cut your leg off.
Yes. It was, they said they were going to try and they kept debriding it.
Yeah.
And about the third or fourth debridement, they said, we're going to try one more time. And if we can't get it clean, we're going to have to take it off.
Oh, man.
Below the knee. So I was lucky. I was lucky.
And then you had about a decade before then you started riding.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep. Yep.
How did it affect your riding in the beginning? Like immediately, were you like going to have to make some modifications to like your stirrup or your boot or how you post? Do you know what I mean? Because you use your feet a lot in riding.
Oh, yes. Yeah. So it was kind of a slow progression of arthritis in the ankle.
Right.
So when I first started riding, the ankle was pretty nimble. I mean, not as nimble as it used to be, but it's pretty nimble. And so as the years progressed, when I first started riding, it really didn't affect the riding that much. But as the years progressed, I would have to change, modify stirrup lengths, modify how I rode, modify how I balanced in the saddle. And so it was progression of how well I could bend it and also level of pain that it would cause to ride in it. So
right. And did you find that you started having downstream like ankle, like opposite ankle, opposite foot, or like knee or hip injuries from contorting yourself around your ankle injury?
Oh, yeah. Yes, because in the body, everything's connected. So
yes,
even whether it's consciously or unconsciously, you
right.
start adopting. And so I would start to have to wear a left, because it was a left ankle, I would start having to wear a left knee brace because a lot of the trauma, because, you know, we take for granted fully functional knees and joints and how they absorb the posts and everything. When you don't have it, it just, the body distributes it to other joints. And so it becomes a stress on the hip, stress on the knee. And then you have to start changing how you sit a saddle, how you jump. I mean, all these different things come into play.
How did you start fox hunting? How far into your riding career were you when you started fox hunting? And how did you get into it?
So the same person that I was taking lessons.
Right.
Phyllis Heck, who was a master at Miami Valley Hunt.
Oh, yeah. So you knew a guy. So often that's the story. You kind of got it. It helps if you know a guy, you know?
Yeah. Phyllis. Yeah. Phyllis. And so I said, hey, I'm really interested in fox hunting. And so she formally invited me to start. And so I started hunting in, I think it's 2000. And then about 3 or 4 years later, they asked me to lead the first field. And with Boomer, my paint. And,
yes.
Oh, my gosh. It was just so much adrenaline and it was so much fun.
There's nothing more fun.
Oh, my gosh. I mean, just the full blown gallops as fast as your horse can gallop across the fields. And
let's give the listeners a little perspective. You also race cars. Right.
Yeah.
Scuba dive all over the world.
Yeah. I teach race car driving.
I believe you showed me a video of you like free swimming with a GoPro. And was that a crocodile? what were you in the water with, John? What was that giant thing? Is it an alligator or a crocodile?
It was an alligator.
That was like as long as my dually truck. And you're like 50 feet from it. And I go, where were you? And you go, Mexico. They let you do anything.
I was 3 feet from it.
Yeah.
It was in Cuba.
Yeah.
And it was the most magnificent creature to see close up.
So when John says leading first light is the biggest rush you'll ever get, he has other large rushes to compare with. It's not like, you know, you're not collecting stamps on the side, you know?
Yeah. And adrenaline stuff from sailing too as well.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, so it's all good fun, Solange.
I like to ask all my fox hunters, what's your favorite memory? What's your favorite memory? What's the coolest thing? What's the craziest thing? Like, what's your one, if you could tell everybody one thing about fox hunting, what's your one story? Like your best cocktail party story.
So it's probably hunting in Ireland. Like 2 years ago, we went over there and for the week to hunt. And one of the hunts, the Irish said it was the fastest hunt they had of the season.
Mm-hmm. Well, because you were there, John. You were their good luck charm.
Oh, my God. It was 5.5 hours of galloping.
Yep.
And jumping 4-foot stone walls.
Yep.
And after about 3 hours, your muscles are gone. You have nothing left. And you are on pure adrenaline.
Yes.
And that is just the most, and you're kind of half near death, and you're having fun. And it was just an amazing to push your body at that level and forget everything you knew about jumping, because it was all down jumps.
Yeah. You just lean back as far as you can possibly. Yeah. Yeah.
And if you have any inkling to tell your horse how to jump, just forget about it.
Right.
They know their jobs. Just stay out of
their way. That's not the place to be fiddly. I remember when I went hunting in Ireland on the first day, there was like a band of like teenage boys between the ages of like maybe 10 and 18 who looked like they like stole horses and tack out of fields like on the way in. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they're in like windbreakers and rubber boots, and they've got the little baubles on their helmets, and they're holding pieces of rubber hose as crops, and the ponies are like not trimmed and barefoot. And we started with like a field of 150 riders, and then at the end there's like 20, you know. And you'd been out like, it was like 6 hours, because you start at like noon at a pub and then you end at like dinner time, like 6 hours later at a pub. So we're kind of trotting down the road. And of the 20 people that are left, 10 of them is this roving band of boys, right? This like hooligan band of like kids who came out. And the littlest one looked to be probably under 12. Like this boy was probably between 10 and 12, and he's on the smallest pony in the field. And we're trotting down the road, and he looks up at one of the older ones who's next to him and goes, "Are we going in?" And the big one looks down and goes, "Yeah, we've been out 6 hours." And the little one went, "Oh, man." Oh, man.
Yes. Well, I mean, for you know, on a lot of the days, they close the schools down. And they just say, this is a hunt day. You know, you're not going to school today.
It's a different world over there.
Yeah. And just they were able to catch their pony, you know, and they're on and they're going to rock and roll. Right, they're dressed in whatever they could find in their room and put in.
And they just love it, and they'll stay out all day with a smile on their face. Well, you mean it's only 6 hours?
And it's the culture. The culture is embedded in there. It's a riding culture, a hunting culture.
Exactly.
Yeah.
All right, John. I know there's a topic that you're passionate about, and I would be remiss to not give you the chance to speak on it. Ball management.
Yeah. So I just don't understand how guys ride without managing the testicles. I just don't understand it.
I think that it's sort of like artificial selection. I think some of them get on and it works better than others. And the one that it works okay keeps riding. And the ones that don't never get back on a horse again.
It's the one. There was a shampoo called No More Tears Shampoo.
Yes.
There's a way to have no more tears. And it's, you know, you have to manage the boys or else you're going to be crying. And so the way I kind of developed the system over the years.
Yes.
Is that it's a combination of bicycle shorts.
Right.
And what's called technically a suspendatory. And it's kind of like a jock strap, but it's more to manage your testicles and keep them high and out of danger.
Is this like an Amazon purchase? Do we Google this? Like,
yes, you could do it. You can. Yeah. Amazon. Yes.
Okay. All right.
And you can get them. Sometimes you can get them at the local pharmacy. I struck up a really good relationship with my pharmacist when we started talking about this and everything.
Right.
But
I bet he remembered you.
She
remembered you.
He did. Oh, here's the ball guy.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so it's really what it does is keeps everything out of harm's way.
And it's a two-step system. You need both, like just one or the other. Do you feel that you really need both together?
You could probably, if you only had the suspendatory, that would work.
Right.
But I just find the bicycle shorts actually help as well. But I've just talked to so many people, and the guys just go, you know, they start, you know, they're like in pain sometimes.
Yes, yes.
And there's no real solution, but this is a solution. This will really, this will create a no more tears environment.
When I started talking to women about not riding on their, I say on social media, their vagina, and then I get a lot of trouble because I should be technically saying vulva, but potato, potato, right? Women experience the same thing, but theirs tends to be more abrasion, like yes, scrubbing, yes. Friction, right? So when I started talking about this, a lot of women came forward. And the more I talk about it, the more women come forward and the more it's best to normalize, right? Because people are suffering and they're not. But then every once in a while, a guy will be like, but me too. And I'm like, I also talk about that. And I always put like little peanut emoji, you know, in my social media. And more than once, you know, a guy will comment. I'll go, if you have further questions, you can message me. And then they do. And then I'm just sitting in my house at like 8:45 at night on like Facebook or TikTok or Instagram Messenger talking to this man I don't know about his underwear. And my husband's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, let me tell you what I'm doing.
Yeah. I asked, we have an Olympic rider at our hunt, Bruce Mandeville.
Yeah.
And I asked him, because he rides a lot of horses and he's been doing this for a long time.
Yeah.
Subject matter expert, Bruce.
Yeah.
What do you do? And he leans forward and he gets into a 2-point and he goes, this is what I do. I go to 2-point.
Right. Years ago, before I met you and I was still hunting full time with Chagrin, I was going to their hunter pace and I was talking to my very good friend and I said, I want to invent men's riding underwear because we have a lot of women's riding bras. We have a lot of riding, like women's riding underwear, but the men don't really have riding underwear and we need to do this because it's a thing. And I said, but unfortunately, we're going to have to get like measurement data. And I don't know if we can trust the gentleman to do it. So I think we're going to have to hire like this old lady nurse to like go around with like tools and get us, you know, like measurements. And then I want to make this, you know, scientifically designed men's riding underwear. And then I want to do a TED talk about it. Like, that's how I want to get on the TED stage. So I go up to the master at the time, Dick Desberg, who I loved dearly, who actually walked me down the aisle at my wedding. And we went to the hunt, the hunter pace. We got out of my truck. I'm like, well, all the dudes are here. I hunt with a bunch of dudes. They're all here. I'm going to ask them. And I walk up to Dick, you know, he's standing there in his barber coat with his coffee mug. And I go, hey, Dick. And he goes, yes. And I go, where do you put your balls when you ride? And he just went, in my coat pocket. Like we wrote it, like a skit. And I was like, oh God. I will never forget that. That was probably, my kid was like one. That was probably 12 years ago. I still haven't designed my scientifically designed men's riding underwear, John. But if I ever get in my copious spare time on this project, you will be one of the first people I come to.
And your product will be called No More Tears. No More Tears.
No More Tears. Somebody's got to talk about this, John.
I know. This is a good time to get it out and get
it's
it
a
out
good
in
time
the world.
to open up the conversation.
People don't want to talk about it. It's uncomfortable.
Right. Well, I think you and I both have the kind of vibe where we're willing to say the thing if need be.
Yes.
So we were hunting together before I even built my lab, right?
Yeah.
And just a few years ago, I did get a chance to teach both you and your amazing wife a rider intensive. You guys were both looking for extra stability in the saddle. And I want to ask you specifically, how do you feel that the tools and the lab and some of the instruction helped you once you got back onto your horse and were back to doing what you loved in the hunt field?
Oh, Solange, your intensive was amazing. It was so logical and made so much sense to me.
I had a lot of fun teaching you guys. I still remember it. We had a great time. God.
And the fact that, you know, if I feel like I'm in danger or something, I go to your physician.
Yep.
And it's because the physics are there, the mechanics are there.
Right.
All the stuff makes sense in terms of energies and moving forward and you know, where are you going to likely come off and how are you going to likely come off?
Yeah.
And you can dial those probabilities back by just changing your riding position.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 100%. So simple. And you presented it in such a straightforward and logical manner.
You know, the thing with what we do when we're trail riding and we're fox hunting It's not even, I feel that so much we have a higher chance of a fall, because I think your chance of falling off a horse or your horse acting out, you know, you're strapped to the back of a horse. The problem is when you're out trail riding and fox hunting, medical help is harder to access.
Yeah.
It's harder to get to you if you really need it. And that's something that I think people who ride in arenas or like eventers where there's, you know, an ambulance at the beginning of course or an ambulance at the end don't appreciate. Like sometimes we're in very difficult to access areas should an injury occur.
Yeah.
And that's something that's that we have to take in consideration when we're so many thousands of acres out, you know, and we went down a big ravine and then up a big ravine and.
Yeah. Yes. Absolutely. I mean, we were just in Montana hunting a couple months ago, Big Sky country.
Mm-hmm.
And the question was, how many acres do you guys hunt? And said, well, right now, including the BFM land, we have about 1 million. And if you're out
million.
In the middle of 1 million huntable acres, and if you're out in the middle of nowhere, you're right. And getting help is going to be a tough one.
Right. So that's something that I consider. I consider what's the terrain, right? What's the slickness of the terrain? What's the rockiness of the terrain? And where am I in relation to if something happens and I need help or one of my riders need help? Because it's part of the logical flow chart, you know?
Yeah.
Recently, it came to a point with your ankle, that your ankle needed a big surgery.
Yes.
And I'm so glad that you told me about it and I was able to assist in that rehab. One of my saddle stands, along with some crutch-friendly mounting stairs that I designed and built, lived in, was at your office for a few months.
Yeah, it was my office, yes.
I'm sure the listeners want to hear about the procedure and also your rehab process, because so many riders end up on some form of rehab journey of their own.
Well, first, Solange, I got to tell you, it was so kind and generous of you to set me up with this. It was just
Care of my riders, John.
Oh my gosh, you do. I was just blown away by your generosity to set this up and to custom build the mounting so you can mount this horse, mechanical horse, with crutches.
Mm-hmm. From the offside too, wasn't it?
From the offside.
Right, I remember that. And because me and three other people are in the lab with the saddle stand with a pair of crutches I borrowed for like an hour going, okay, how are we going to do this?
Yeah, so I just want to say, first of all, it was just so kind and generous of you to do this. And it was exactly
what
I needed.
Yeah.
Because I couldn't do anything else. I mean, I was basically couch ridden for months. It was basically my ankle got to a point where I had to get it fused.
Right.
And so they fused it, and it was probably fully a year to kind of get back to doing what I needed to do. But your generosity of setting me up with this mechanical horse, which I turned into a little Peloton.
Mm-hmm.
I had a screen which I used to play my Ireland videos, the GoPro on my forehead, and I would post and I would do horsey stuff to get muscles from not atrophying.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing I would say is do the best you can to not atrophy is muscles, which is basically do whatever you can just to keep moving. And find things that mimic the muscles you use to horse ride. So because of you, I would go and I would hunt in Ireland every day.
I remember probably over a decade ago now, reading an article about the prima ballerina, Misty Copeland, is that her name? Who had a stress fracture in her leg. Big surprise, right? So she was non-weight bearing for a period of time. So her dance, I don't know what they would be, coaches, instructors, or whoever, would lay blankets out on the floor, and she would lay on the floor and she would go through her whole routine laying flat. So she could still remember her routine, remember her facial expressions, the timing, the arm movements, the hand, you know, down to the fingertips. And I thought that was such an interesting modification. And Hugh, the Mongol Derby rider who rode last year very successfully, had come to my house twice to do intensives. And on the first one, he told me that 10 years prior, when he was 50, he'd fallen off the roof of his house and crushed both of his heels.
Oh.
And they did this reconstructive surgery that the surgeon, I think, ended up teaching at like Harvard or something. It was some great surgery. And as soon as he got released from the hospital in his wheelchair, he asked a friend to lower his speed bag so that he could still box from his wheelchair. And I looked at him. I said, "See, Hugh, this is why you're just going to do just fine in the Derby." Because it's that mentality, right?
Yes.
Well, just absolutely. Because I can't do this, I can also do this in the meantime.
Yes, right? Absolutely. And YouTube is a great source for that as well. Okay, you have a severe ankle injury. What exercises can you do?
Right. Because you were non-weight bearing for a long time.
Long time. Yeah. Yeah. Non-weight bearing. So, but coming back and having your horse, and then I rode a little bit sooner than my doctor knew that I rode. But,
big surprise. Who's shocked? Nobody.
So, but it actually, there's less, at that point, it was naturally fused almost because of the body just shut it down. Mm-hmm. But then it got more fused when they actually fused it.
Mm-hmm.
But it changed how I didn't have pain in it anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So I could eventually start having, because I used to ride with one stirrup, two or three notches lower than the other one.
I remember.
And so I would just be riding with basically one leg.
Yes.
And I had to relearn how to ride in a balanced seat with both equal pressure in both stirrups, which I now do.
Yeah.
And then the atrophy, you lose it quickly, especially when you get older. So
yeah.
Just gotta keep at it and do other exercises. Like I cycled 21 miles this morning. I cycle every other day, and I ride 6 miles every other day.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So, that's how you do it.
Yeah.
So, word on the street is that you have a lovely new lady in your life.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell us all about the mare you recently purchased? Is she your first mare, too?
She's my first girl. You know, there's a difference between girls and guys.
There is, yes. Yeah.
Yeah.
A couple.
Yeah. Bookie, short for book club.
I love that name.
And she's an absolute sweetie and jumps, and just if you point her something, she's going over it.
Yeah.
I've hunted her about 6 times, got her from this wonderful woman, Angela, in Tennessee, who hunts 5 days a week, and all she does is specialize in fox hunter horses.
Yes.
And when you go down to try your horse out, you try him in a hunt field, which is what you really need to do.
That's what you really need to do. 100%.
Not go around in an indoor arena and go, "Oh yeah, it was really sweet."
Right.
But
no, that's the appropriate test drive.
Yeah, and I think that's something you mentioned as well. So you know she's great, and Linda just got a new horse as well. So
I'm so happy for both of you. And I like that you have a mare. It's a different kind of relationship. So it'll be interesting. I think you'll enjoy it.
I love it.
That's awesome.
She's great.
So many riders have complex body histories. Some are born with them. Some collect their injuries from riding. And some of us collect injuries from other sports or just life just in general, right? What advice would you have for a rider out there who has a complex body history and is concerned it will hold them back from achieving their goals?
Don't give up. I mean, it's just most of our limitations are between our ears.
Wow. Isn't that the truth, John?
So you just need to focus on the basics and keep a good attitude, because the only thing that's going to limit you is your attitude.
Well, and you have a fabulous attitude, John. And I know I only see you some of the time, and I'm sure there are days when you're grumpy, but every time I've ever seen you, your vibe is very upbeat, very positive, very happy, very open and encouraged for new experiences, you know?
That's because I'm around you, Solange.
Oh, wow.
That's what the effect you have on me. No, you're the same way.
I think it's a big part of our success with our horses.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And with some of the, you know, the complications and setbacks and bumps along the road that come from riding and having horses and doing the complicated things we do, that if you can have a good disposition, it really makes things go a lot easier. Never waste adversity, you know?
Yeah. And always keep in mind that it takes 2 lifetimes to learn to ride.
Oh, yeah. Totally. 1,000,000%.
And my horse Bookie will always be a better horse than I am a rider.
Yeah, because so she's a horse all the time. You're only a rider some of the time. She exactly. was born for the role, literally.
Yeah, so just don't give up and just go for it. Mysterious forces will come to your aid.
Always.
Yes.
Thank you so much, John, for taking the time to tell us your riding story. I think that was pretty awesome. Today's episode is number 11 of Stable Riding with Solange. Who can believe it? It's already been almost a whole year of me talking to riders all about riders. And for next month's episode in August, episode 12, our 1 year anniversary episode, we're going to celebrate with listener questions. This is where we turn our regular format on its head. And instead of you or me interviewing you, you guys get to interview me. So I have a big favor to ask of y'all. I'm looking for questions. You can ask questions about me, my riding, or my stable riding system. You can ask questions about the podcast itself, or questions about just riding in general, or even your own riding. This is your chance to dictate the content and tell us exactly what you want to hear. How do you submit your questions? Easy. Send them to me on any of the social media platforms. I'm Stable Riding on TikTok, Instagram, and Facebook. You can also email me directly at stableriding.us. I already have some pretty good ones sent in, but I'd love even more. And if I'm lucky enough to get too many, then maybe I'll answer one question an episode for a while moving forwards. For today's rider tip and homework, I've decided to talk about leg aids and kicking in honor of John's ankle. Leg aids can be a thorny subject, as all the different disciplines have their own idea and ideal leg position that then impacts on how they prefer to have the leg aid look in the show and competition rings. Since I don't know what discipline any of you particular listeners are riding, I'm going to talk about the most basic form of moving your leg below the knee to place pressure on the horse's side and ask said horse to either transition up into a faster gait, to add impulsion to the gait they were already in, or to move over laterally. The leg aid motion and placement I teach here and will describe here is based on how your horse hears your leg. And the highest tactile contrast of that leg pressure so that it's easiest for you and your horse to know what you are asking. Today I will describe leg aids without spurs, as that is a more complex skill that you would access once this base skill is already learned. And going forward, I'm going to refer to this motion as kicking. Now, how hard the pressure needs to be, and then how you choose to describe it, can be anywhere on a scale of barely touching your horse to a big old womp womp, like little kid pony club kick. And this, of course, depends on the horse's training, disposition, environment, situation, etc. But see, regardless of the pressure you need to apply as the rider, the physical motion is the same, which is what I'm going to talk about here. And if you do have a pressure question, you know what I'm going to say? Email me. And if you happen to be a hardcore competitor and would like to modify anything you see me hear me say here today into something that's rewarded and correct for your particular show ring, that's right, email me. And together we can make that modification for your show position. So first I'm going to explain it. In your base lower leg position, with your toe out in 45 degrees, your heel down, and your lower leg on the vertical line to the ground, the lower half of your lower leg from the middle of your calf down will curve away from the horse in a crescent moon shape. The longer the leg and the narrower the horse, the more your leg curves away. But even the shortest leg on a really wide horse, if your lower leg is in that correct position, the lower half of your lower leg will be away from the horse. What this means is that your horse will not feel the lower half of your leg unless you choose to physically move your leg back to their side behind the girth and touch them there. This gives the leg pressure a very obvious application and release. You can put your leg on and then you can take your leg off. This is, again, a visible leg aid in motion. So it's very high contrast for riders when they look at another rider riding, and also for the horse with how it feels so the horse can really hear what you're saying. This is, again, discouraged in the show arena, as they want you to ride your horse without them seeing you ride your horse. You know what I mean? That can be a conversation for another day. Some of the common problems riders have when they go to kick are as follows. They lose their stirrups. They move their arms. They tip forward from their waist, like the drinking bird, like desk toys. They pull up a knee, which tips them over the other way if they're using one leg and pops them up out of the saddle if they're using both legs. They use a really big dramatic kicking motion that by the time their leg actually reaches their horse, they barely have any oomph left and their leg just sort of bounces off ineffectively, like a little tink, like a Tinkerbell kick, which does not really communicate to the horse, hey dude, you gotta move. Also, kicking while posting is a high level skill. So in the beginning, you're only going to be able to kick while sitting down. So all of these instructions are going to be while the rider is sitting in their deep seat position. Here are the steps on how to kick correctly. Step one, straighten your elbow joint to lower your forearms, which keeps your hands down. If you struggle with this, I recommend practicing the kicking motion with the bottom of your fists or hands on the front of the saddle. Or you can hold on to a neck strap around the horse's neck. See, you might need to give your hands a job to keep them in place. Two, lean back from your waist the amount necessary to make sure that your weight is staying in your seat bones for the full course of the movement. You cannot tip forward from your waist as you bring your legs back to kick. Step three, with your heels down, toes out at that 45-degree angle, straighten your knee to push your leg slightly in front of the vertical line from the ground. Once your leg is slightly in front of that line, we start step four, which is where from your knee only, you are going to swing or snap your lower leg back on that same 45-degree angle line until some part of your leg touches some part of the horse's side. The part of you that touches them and what part of them that is all decided by rider leg length, horse width, and stirrup length. So it varies. And often riders get kind of messed up trying to use a very specific part of their leg on a very specific part of the horse's side. And generally, this does not matter. Leg on horse means leg on horse to the horse. Now, in high-level riders and high-level horses, is this a thing? Totally. You can put your leg three different ways in two different positions. And the horse all knows what that means. But those riders who are riding at that level already know how to kick and therefore do not require this instruction as they already have it. This part of the motion where you bring your leg back is often where riders lose contact with their stirrup. So the key is as you bring your leg back from your knee, you pull your heel up and push the ball of your foot into your stirrup to take the stirrup with you. Then when you release the pressure and swing your leg back off the horse, you rotate your foot around the stirrup and push your weight back down into your heel. It's an easy pendulum-type swinging motion that sounds harder than it is when I explain it, but don't worry, it's not that hard. You'll be able to figure it out. Step five, once your leg makes contact with the horse, you have to leave it there and hold the pressure until the horse responds, then release. If the horse does not respond, leave it on for like 2 seconds, and then release and repeat the motion until the horse responds. You must kick and hold, not just flat bounce your legs off their sides, because that doesn't sound like a command or a leg aid. It just sounds like you're moving your leg around. And it trains your horse to ignore your leg pressure, which is bad. Rider tip, practice the physical motion of moving your leg to kick, one leg at a time, and then both. But how? We can't just kick our horses for no reasons. So we got to make up some reasons. You want to practice putting one leg on at a time? Weave in and out of cones. You want to practice using both legs at once? Do halt walk transitions where you can both practice stopping and going. My two favorite things to have a horse do. If you struggle at first, try walking with your feet out of your stirrups and kicking practice. Kicking is always easier in the beginning without your stirrups. And then once you get the hang of it without your stirrups, add the stirrups back. And as always, start at the walk. And then once you feel comfortable with the walk, increase to the trot and the canter and the gallop if you're feeling fancy. For how long should you do this exercise? The usual. 10 minutes a ride, baby. 10 minutes a ride will change your life. You can find our show notes and links to today's guest and products in the show notes on your podcast player or on the website at stableriding.us. We are on Facebook, Instagram, and TikTok as Stable Riding. We're here once a month on the fourth Tuesday of every month. We have our own open RSS feed. Just search Stable Riding with Solange in your podcast player, or you can find us on the main Horses in the Morning feed. All riders can be stable riders, and a stable rider makes for a happy horse.